And you're listening to Indy Bay Radio here in San Francisco. And in the series of ongoing conversations and interviews with candidates throughout the nation, we have on the phone with us Byron DeYoung. And you're a candidate for the 28th District, U.S. Congressional District in California. And let's see, I think you mentioned off the air that your district would be in the San Fernando Valley, kind of north L.A.?
Fernando Valley, and David, just to remind you, the name's Byron DeLeer.
Oh, I'm sorry, DeLeer, yeah.
That's fine, and but the 28th Congressional District, I'm running for the House of Representatives seats. The 28th Congressional District is Studio City, Sherman Oaks, Encino, North Hollywood, Van Nuys, Pacoima, Arleta, Panorama City, a little bit of the Hollywood Hills, a little bit of Sylmar, and the Hollywood Bowl is in my district, so there's some good concerts that go on.
Oh, yeah, you're going to have a... I can imagine what your fundraisers are going to be like. You've got about as much talent down there as we do up here in San Francisco. Now, let's see. Tell me something about your background. What sort of training have you got, and what inspired you?
The primary motivation for me to move to Los Angeles was work in show business. And I'm a musician, singer, songwriter, record producer. I've worked in music production and pretty much wearing every hat you can wear in the music industry for about 20 years. Worked for major labels. My last stint was working at 20th Century Fox, and I affectionately like to say that my boss was Darth Vader in the form of Rupert Murdoch. And went through a sort of transformative experience after 9/11, and decided that there was just a gross absence of any creativity being expressed out of Washington, D.C. And so I sold my house in Sherman Oaks, and I bought a ticket to the Middle East, and I flew to the Middle East and met with high-level leadership in the Palestinian Authority and the Israeli government and in Egypt as well, and started working on peace initiatives in the Middle East. I aligned our efforts with an organization called MIFCOD, which was forwarding a six-point peace initiative in Palestine and Israel, and formed a nonprofit organization called Global Peace Solution, which can be found at globalpeacesolution.org. And I guess, David, that this congressional run that I'm doing right now is just an extension of my civic activism, just taking everything to the next level.
Well, and it's very necessary. When you look at the district that you're running in, there's this huge Gordian knot of, as many people know, L.A. was created in, what was it, essentially flatlands, desert. It's got surrounded by the mountains in such a way that any fires down in there create smog. And as city planning went back, short of 100 years ago, they did do a lot of planning, laying out streetcar tracks and mass transit. But by the 30s and was it possibly the 40s, the major corporations had essentially crushed them. And
yes, you know, I talked about this. I'm up here in Vancouver right now presenting at the World Peace Forum on peace and sustainability. And David, one of the things that I mentioned was the holding company NCL, the multinational conglomerate, collection of multinational conglomerates in the form of Standard Oil and General Motors and Firestone, who had methodically purchased the electric trolley system in Los Angeles, which at the time was the leading mass transit, intercity electric mass transit system in the nation, carrying upwards of 80 million passengers a year. And so this holding company, NCL, purchased it. They systematically dismantled it so they could populate the highways and streets with more cars burning gasoline and using tires. And it didn't just stop in L.A. They did this in 45 different cities across the nation, and it just very succinctly frames how, in an effort to blow up the bottom line at any cost, you have these behemoth, monolithic institutions of profit working directly against the community's interests. And what's the result today? The result is that Los Angeles is the worst polluted city in the nation. The top five polluted cities in the nation are in California, that Los Angeles leads the nation in traffic congestion. And so this is the case where we have a systemic flaw in our economic system, and a lot of this has been discussed up here in Vancouver at the World Peace Forum. But another couple issues that we brought to the attention of the folks up here going on in Southern California is that I sit on the Physicians for Social Responsibility Nuclear Nonproliferation Committee, and the Physicians for Social Responsibility down in Los Angeles just conducted its first military tour of Los Angeles. And what we did is we went to all the different military sites in Los Angeles. And through the 50s and 60s and 70s, there was a point where Los Angeles was the recipient of 10% of the Department of Defense, the total Department of Defense budget, because of all the military defense contractors, and that's a euphemism. They really should be called offense contractors, because we certainly don't have a Department of Defense as much as a Department of Offense. But one of the sites that we saw was the Rocketdyne site, which is home to the world's only uncontained partial nuclear meltdown. And strontium-90 and perchlorate have been found in the groundwater and in the soil and in the air. And in an effort to save money, once again, these defense contractors, these Pentagon defense contractors, would take the radioactive waste and take the chemical toxic waste and burn it in open pits to get rid of it. Recently, under EPA guidance, a neighboring children's summer camp was searched and detected. They detected strontium-90 and perchlorate and various heavy metals, and there's been cancer clusters found amongst the residents and workers. And, of course, the corporations had settled out of court, and details of the settlement were not known. They did this with over 100 different neighbors in the area there in Simi Valley, which is just outside the 28th District. And another issue of great concern that I know a lot of folks in San Francisco are aware of, and by the way, I was born in the Bay Area. I was born in Mountain View, so I feel like I'm talking to my place of birth here in the
city. Sure, region. Sure.
But another great issue that the Greens down in Los Angeles were attempting to call attention to was the South Central Farm, which was a 14-acre tract of land, and it was the largest urban farm in the United States. We were saying that this is a national treasure. Indeed, it is worthy of national monument status. And yet, because of the situation where developers control the politics in Los Angeles, and this is no exaggeration, David, because I heard directly from the deputy mayor of Los Angeles as he was addressing the Neighborhood Council Alliance, which was an association of all the neighborhood councils there in Los Angeles. He said very simply that developers control the politics in L.A. And this is a wake-up call. Because when you have a beautiful oasis of life in the middle of a concrete jungle like the South Central Farm was, and the government was unable to make a robber baron in the form of Ralph Horowitz go away, that government has failed in its service to the community. And we have seen eminent domain incessantly used and abused for economic and commercial purposes. For once, we were wanting to see eminent domain, and we wanted to see Villaraigosa, the mayor, stand up and assert eminent domain, because the $16 million had been raised. We wanted to see the mayor stand up and satiate his proclamation of being green by his own lights, because certainly this national treasure, the beginning evidences of sustainability, was worth protecting and giving these subsistence farmers and these 360 families that had been lovingly tilling that ground the opportunity to continue to do so.
Well, and the logic as well that you have for the last 20, 30 years, frankly, actually, for the last 100 years, the number of farmers in America has been rapidly decreasing since the end of Jimmy Carter's term. I think just in the 12 years that Reagan and Bush were in office, through the magic of the savings and loans fraud, three-quarters of the U.S. farmers went out of business, three-quarters of them. We went from, I think it was 5% of the U.S. population was farming. We went down to 1.5%. So the idea that you have this, even if it's a minimal 350 farmers in L.A., that's an idea of being able to train kids in how to do gardening and farming, and that's a rapidly declining education or skill set. And the idea that we would actually lose an educative opportunity like that, when you look at the aerial photographs of L.A. and was it about a 15-acre parcel?
It was a one city block, 14 acres, yes.
Yeah, and the idea that you could throw away that opportunity of teaching people how to grow food in this massive expanse of subdivision tract homes, was, I could imagine even the school district getting involved in that, because it's such a necessity for a civilization to train their next generation in how to grow food.
There was a plan that John Quigley was forwarding where we would make this, where the South Central Farm would become an international attraction based on it being representative of the beginning evidences of sustainability, reattaching ourselves to the Mother Earth. This is the transformation that we are all going to need to embrace. You know, I'm actually sitting right now in the Post Carbon Institute office here in Vancouver, and the South Central Farm represents an approach towards addressing the global warming because it acts as a carbon sink. But we just took a tour of an experimental energy farm here up in Vancouver that was part of the University of British Columbia, where the World Peace Forum was being held. We just took a tour, and we saw all the amazing different crops that are being grown there in sustainable, renewable ways. And one of the interesting stories that we heard from the Post Carbon Institute director, Julian Darley, was they're growing a crop of I believe it's kanaf. And this is a plant that will be able to be turned into paper products so that all these forests won't be razed and burned, so that trees can be grown to harvest wood pulp to make these paper products. So it's an amazing thing what's going on up here in Vancouver. And one of the issues that was being discussed a ton up here at the conference, of course, is peak oil. And we heard from Jack Santa Barbara, was on the panel that I was on peace and sustainability. And Jack Santa Barbara talked about the necessity to bring the environment and energy into the peace movement. Of course, Wangari Maathai, the environmentalist from Kenya who had just won the Nobel Peace Prize, was making that connection and bringing it into a popular forum, winning the Nobel Peace Prize, bringing the environment and peace movement together. But the way Jack Santa Barbara framed it is that we have a huge locomotive called peak oil that's ready to break into our reality here in civilization. And we have to start to find shorter routes to bring food into our lives, and we have to start growing food locally. And I know a lot of the folks up in San Francisco, the San Francisco Green Party, Susan King and Mark Solomon, they're super troopers up there in regard to these issues and the decentralized aspects of the evolutionary political doctrine that the Greens forward. So this is exciting times. I think we have a window of opportunity to really start to champion these folks that are doing the heavy lifting. And indeed, Post Carbon Institute and Julian Darley are really walking the walk and investing in this farm and getting volunteers to come out here. They're also going to be building some wind turbines. I think the plans are set for about a dozen wind turbines, so that you can kind of combine the whole issue of growing food and energy production in a decentralized and relocalized way. So if you guys want to check that out, I'm sure anybody can Google Post Carbon Institute, and they've got some amazing projects working on up here. But, David, I just really wanted to briefly talk a little bit about the Iraqi war and about what's going on with the gentleman that I'm running against in Southern California. I'm running against a pro-war establishment, corporate-handled candidate, incumbent by the name of Howard Berman. And Howard Berman just recently made the front page headline of the Daily News, and it said, Berman sides with GOP on Iraq. And I put together a nice big poster of that headline about a 2-foot by 4-foot poster, and we held a press conference in front of Howard Berman's office. And what I just wanted to offer your audiences is that what we're building is an anti-war coalition of Greens, of progressive Democrats, because 80% of the Democrats in the United States are opposed to this Iraqi war. And the folks in the San Fernando Valley are no stranger to that statistic. And Howard Berman has shown himself to be completely detached from his constituency in forwarding this war and continuing to fund this war. And I'll make the argument that the Daily News is understood to be a bit of a conservative newspaper. And I'll make the argument that when they are able to splash down the headline of a Democrat that's breathing life into this dysfunctional quagmire, that that actually translates to American soldiers dying, American soldiers being wounded, and Iraqi civilians being dying. It invests in the trauma, murder, mayhem, cruelty, and torture that that the Bush administration has been forwarding. I delivered the State of the Union rebuttal for the United States Green Party along with four other Greens, and I was charged to talk on Iraq and impeachment. And I called for Cheney and Bush's impeachment in that rebuttal because when you consider the laundry list of malevolent and illegal and deceptive actions that this administration has foisted upon the American people, there's a mechanism in place to deal with politicians and their high crimes. And that's why I believe that impeachment proceedings should begin. If I am elected, I will forward the call for impeachment proceedings. And this is the time for Americans to stand up and to see beyond any of the kind of partisan issues that we may have, because there's a ton of Republicans that feel disenfranchised by what's going on in D.C. I mean, consider the aspect of fiscal conservatism for a moment, that conservatives wear on their sleeves. Did you realize that the amount of money that the Bush administration has spent since 2001, $4.24 trillion, eclipses the entire combined administrations from 1792 to the present?
Well, that's right.
Excluding the Bush administration, which totals $4 trillion. So you can see how detached they've come, not only from the Democratic vision, but also from the traditional conservative vision. So this is the time for people to come together, and I'd encourage anybody out there to check out my website, DeLeerForCongress.org.
And then, go ahead, why don't you spell it again, DeLeer?
It's DeLeerForCongress.org.
Okay, good. And it's Byron DeLeer.
Byron
and,
DeLeer.
Yeah, that's well stated about the deficit that we're going in. And what's amazing about it, I'm not sure if you're aware of it, but when Bush, about a year and a half ago, Bush went off to Africa as part of the development of GATT, and I think it was the African inclusion into GATT, and the moment his plane left the tarmac, the Treasury Department came out with a study saying that they were looking for a $44 trillion deficit. And this idea, this was at a point when the 4-point X deficit you were just mentioning was still a gleam in their eye. I think we were at 2 or so at the time. And it was an unbelievable number that they actually are looking at a $44 trillion deficit.
I mean, it's transparently a money and land grab.
Right.
Because another one of the topics of popular topics up here at the World Peace Forum is, of course, the corporation and the multinational conglomerate entity. I don't know if most of your audience, I'm sure, is familiar with the documentary called The Corporation, which was put together by a lot of the folks up here at University of British Columbia coming down out of Vancouver. And one of the aspects, what a corporation will attempt to do in a sort of a neo-imperial fashion, this subtler form of feudalism, a new monetary monarchy, if you will. What the corporation will try to do is, of course, is externalize the costs of doing business onto unsuspecting shoulders. And that's completely what's occurred in Iraq and Afghanistan. And also the deficit spending that occurs in the destruction of the environment. Because as it puts forth in the documentary, The Corporation, every living system on the planet is in decline. It's a methodical genocide being conducted on the garden that we live in. And these trade agreements, like you had mentioned, GATT and NAFTA and CAFTA, these are concocted by financial ministers and moneyed interests. And they're not crafted with a humanitarian purpose by any sense of the imagination. And largely the work of the 21st century is going to be humanizing and democratizing our global community. And we as Greens see that we have a historic opportunity to compose evolutionary principles for more sustainable expression of civilization. And that's going to involve what I like to call the separation of buck and state.
Yeah, well said. You know, you're actually in a district that's very, very unique. It's almost as, I don't want to say white bread middle class, but it's definitely one of those districts that is, aren't you in the Valley Girl district?
Yes, well, it is the Valley Girl district, but I have to say that demographically in the last few years, we have seen a large Latino population arise, and I have to point out again, this is one of Berman's high crimes and misdemeanors. Howard Berman, my opponent, the incumbent that I'm running against. After every census, every 10 years in the United States, the politicians, parts of the Republicans or Democrats, or what Noam Chomsky likes to call the two-tiered unilateral business war party, what these politicians will get the opportunity to do is to secure their seats by gerrymandering districts. And in the case of the 2000 census, the 28th district was seen to have 61% Latinos.
Okay, good.
And what happened was, is that Berman doesn't want to represent Latinos. He doesn't want to represent, his core constituency is the affluent communities in Encino and Sherman Oaks, not in Pacoima, Arleta, Panorama City, and Sylmar. So what he sought to do through his brother, Michael Berman, who was a political consultant and responsible for a lot of the gerrymandering, is he sought to disenfranchise Latino voters. He sought to reduce the Hispanic community in his district. And they lowered the percentage after the kibitzing around and moving the borders around and gerrymandering. They lowered the Hispanics in the district from 61% to 51%. But they put too many Latinos in Brad Sherman's district, the district next door, which is District 27. So then Sherman and Berman started to do the Latino potato toss, if you can believe it. And they arrived at 55% Latinos in the 28th district. And what I'm talking to the Hispanic community, and there's an organization called Latinos to Elect Byron DeLeer for Congress, head up by the director of the Sylmar Neighborhood Council, Eugene Hernandez, and also Edwin Ramirez, the president of the Pacoima Neighborhood Council. What I'm calling out attention to and what I'm focusing on to this community is I'm saying that Howard Berman is working against the majority of constituents in his district, and inasmuch he has sacrificed his legitimacy to hold this seat. And so we're getting some very interesting response from this message, and when people look at the journalistic record of what has occurred with Howard and this gerrymandering situation, I believe he was sued by some members of the Mexican-American Political Association in regard to this situation, and they did not win the lawsuit because, as you know, a lot of these judges and the legal system is owned by the same overarching moneyed interest that has transcended sovereign politics in a global sense. So this is one of the things that we're calling attention to, and we're bringing together the Hispanic community, the anti-war progressive community, and in addition to that, the folks that are environmentally concerned over the years, and as well as the recent joiners of the environmental movement due to wonderful films like An Inconvenient Truth by Al Gore. We're bringing this coalition together to oust what is an obsolete expression of governance and what is an establishment and a representative capacity that needs to be exited from the political stage in the form of Representative Howard Berman.
Well, you know, that's kind of leading up to where I was going with that previous question. Looking at the district that you're in such a district of middle-class America that the ideas that Al Gore, for example, is trying to raise with his film, that environmentalists and people from the environmental and social justice community and honest economics community have been trying to raise for years, now these issues are really flat on the, right in front of our eyes. And so your campaign is going to give a real opportunity to display it to the choice constituents of the Howard Bermans, for example, and it's going to give you an opportunity to show, and frankly, I guess your training and previous work experience in media, it'll give an opportunity to educate these people, because as you were just describing, the disenfranchisement of Latinos is one thing, but even the affluent are definitely under attack. When if you look at the history of corporate state, those that don't support the masters in charge are targeted as well. So the affluent all across America are being attacked in any number of different ways. The pension funds are being raided. The real estate financial securities markets are being looted in a variety of different ways, and with hyperinflation.
Well, Howard Zinn, this brings up a thing that he puts forward in People's History of the United States. He says that when he's talking about the kind of revolution that needs to take place, I like to say take the R out of revolution and evolve. I think that we need an evolutionary political doctrine, but that's just sort of a question of semantics. But Howard Zinn talks about compartmentalizing the United States culture into three different categories. You've got the prisoners of the system, largely the lower and middle class, lower and middle income wage earners. And then you have the prisoners of the system. You have the guards of the system. These are folks that may have portfolios and be homeowners. And then you have the establishment. And what he says is that when the prisoners and the guards realize that they have more in common, this is when a determined population can actually cause the fundamental changes on a core level that need to occur. And a large portion of my district are folks that work in show business and work in the entertainment community. And we've seen over the years how in the classic conflict between art and commerce, how commerce has always won the day. And I know that there are a lot of great producers and writers and actors, not necessarily the suits in show business. These are the folks that the quote unquote suits. These are the folks that that Howard Berman represents as the Democrat Party's representative to the entertainment industry. I'm talking about the talent. I'm talking about the guys that are doing the real creative efforts. And it's the responsibility of the artists of the planet to stand up and to start to devote some of their inspiration and talent and creativity towards crafting the visionary solutions that need to take place to save our planet and to save our civilization and to arrive at any kind of decent level of survivability that we would wish for our children's children, which is certainly not going to be the result of the trajectory that we're on today. It's very harrowing when you see an inconvenient truth. And Al Gore lays out the argument. I mean, the only thing he doesn't do at the end of that thing is say vote green, because the two corporate-handled parties are not going to take the broad strokes necessary because they're encumbered by the burdens of profitability. 98% of the politicians that get elected today wield the largest campaign war chests, which begs the question, why even count votes anymore?
Well, that gets into, I've done some interviews now with Forrest Hill is running for Secretary of State in California as a Green.
Yes, I know Forrest. He's a wonderful MIT doctor. And, he has his PhD from MIT and is a wonderful contribution to the green slate.
Right, and Mike Wyman is also running as the Attorney General candidate, and I've interviewed both of them, and the idea of taking away the corporate charters of these criminal enterprises that call themselves corporations, who under the terms of 1776 would be seen as pirates or parasites on the American economy.
Right.
And the idea that they are given free license to do business in a community, and they will suck the money out of town, they will suck it out of the state, they will suck it out of the nation, and that can only be seen as colonization in the view of the founding fathers and well up into the 21st or the 20th century. The idea of interstate banking wasn't changed until the Reagan administration. The idea that you could freely just come into a state and automatically expect a business license is a fiction. That was something that has really only emerged in the last 20 or so years, that most corporations had to prove that they were going to do some good to the community. Otherwise, they wouldn't get a business license.
This is really methodically broken down, again, in that documentary, The Corporation. And again, I'm talking to you from the Post-Carbon Institute. And I'd like to just bring up a quality that the green evolutionary political vision brings to this situation of it's actually kind of a new and not so different slave issue to resolve, and that is multinational corporations foisting upon the American people these products that are coming out of virtual indentured servitude halfway across the world. And oil is used, and greenhouse gases are expelled into the atmosphere to bring these products all the way across the world. And local workers are put out of work in the local communities so that corporations like Walmart can come through and build these huge box houses. And did you know, David, that 60% of all Americans visit Walmart once a week? And when 70% of these products are produced by questionable labor practices, where you have folks working 70 to 80 hours a week, they get fined for talking to their assembly line neighbors, they earn 17 cents an hour. I mean, it's unconscionable that we're being forced to subscribe to a virtual system of slavery, and we do it with blinders on, don't we? We do it with blinders on because the mainstream deluge, the mainstream media would have us amplify our appetites for a brand new dot, dot, dot. But one of the aspects of the Green Party that will never be able to be usurped by greenwashing pseudo-environmentalists like Arnold Schwarzenegger, the so-called green governor, or even Antonio Villaraigosa, who fancies himself green by his own lights. One of the aspects of the Green Party that will not be able to be taken over or hijacked by corporations like British Petroleum, who spend millions and millions of dollars trying to re-educate the public as to thinking that they're beyond petroleum, and yet they're pulling more black gold, more dino juice out of the ground than ever before. One of the aspects is that the Green Party is an international movement. There's green parties all over the world. You have green parties in Germany, in Australia. I attended the formalization of the Asia-Pacific Greens Network in Kyoto, Japan, where 45 different nations came together to talk about the kind of carbon taxes that could be applied towards the fossil fuel-based economies, and to talk about and to share what their particular green issues are with their cities and nations that they're from. But the Greens have political parties. I don't know if most of my audience probably doesn't know this, but the third most powerful Green Party in the world is in Mexico. You have 17 congressmen and 5 senators who are part of Partido Verde Ecologistas in Mexico. And four of those senators are women.
Well, I'll tell you, if you go to greens.org, you'll find the main Green Party website, and the expansiveness of Greens is wonderful in its right. There are 7 continents on the planet, and we are on 6 of them, and the only one that we don't want to make green is Antarctica, because that would be a foreshadowing of the worst of global warming. So, you know, let's limit ourselves to the six green continents and leave one snowy white.
Yes, very good. And just to build on that call to action on six continents that you just made, the multinational conglomerate entity that we were speaking about earlier has transcended sovereign politics and resides above the fray of nations. And the work of the 20th century is going to be to democratize and to bring that system into a harmonious relationship with the garden that sustains us, our precious Mother Earth. Mother and her children must not move in opposite direction. That is not a sustainable plan. So we need to reattach ourselves to the life that birthed us and that supports us, and bring civilization to higher ground. And that's only going to come from a longer term vision and plan for our species to be enacted upon. And the folks that have the best grasp of that plan are the ethical scientists and the academic community, who largely now are bought out and paid for when it's convenient for the power mongers and corporatists. And who needs to grab the reins of control in our world are the social physicians and the civil gardeners, not the power mongers, the war mongers, and corporatists. Recently, back in September, I took part in the anti-war march in Washington, D.C., and we saw about 400,000 people hit the streets, hit the National Mall, and it was the first time that I visited Washington, D.C., and the Greens marched in that protest, and we paused in front of the offices of Halliburton, and I said, when wearing political costumes, oil men securing oil fields is a conflict of interest. And this is really the fundamental shift that we need to see in our corridors of power. We need to have statesmen and not folks that are selling. We need folks that are serving.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Thomas Jefferson, in his second inaugural, said that his economy was going to be based upon agriculture with commerce as its handmaiden. And the idea that essentially the ecosystem should be the basis on which we live, and that the needs of commerce should be only secondary to the ecosystem. So even he was well aware of this problem of never-ending spiral of advertising cheap junk and keeping your population insecure so that they have to go out and buy new cheap junk in order to keep their egos assuaged. And that's one of the reasons why you're in such a unique district. Even though you the Valley Girl, so to speak, sensibility is there, it's this opportunity to really get these people seriously involved in self-preservation. The idea that they've been living in some sort of an imaginary bubble for so many decades, it's obviously a necessity, but it's also this experiment in self-preservation to see how and what it's going to take to get middle America, or the people who have been living in apartments and gated communities and the bubble of an imaginary ecosystem, how to get them seriously involved in their own self-preservation. So this might be a good opportunity. I'm looking at the map of the 28th Congressional District. It runs San Fernando at the north. You've got it's sort of an upside-down T shape.
It's kind of like a sombrero is what I like to refer to it as.
Yeah, and Van Nuys is pretty much in the middle, about where the hat band would be. And then I guess I'm trying to think.
There's the whole Ventura Corridor. We've got about 10 miles of, and the Ventura Corridor runs probably about 20 miles in totality. And it's just a ton of mom and pop entrepreneurial little shops, in addition to a few Targets and a few big box houses like Office Depot and things like this. But overwhelmingly, it's a lot of local family businesses. And one of the things that I'm talking to these family entrepreneurs in my district is I'm saying, look, you're going to get a ton of lip service from the Republican Party and even from Democrats that they support entrepreneurial spirit and they support family businesses, which make up a large majority of the American economy. But in reality, who they're serving are their corporate handlers, and they're serving these multinational conglomerates again who wield such leverage and power that it's unparalleled in the history of the planet. We should all be talking about the F word more, fascism, as Sheldon Drobny, the co-founder of Air America Radio, expressed on my television show that I host at Global Peace Network, because the fascism that Franklin Delano Roosevelt defined was when corporate power, when economic power makes the governmental institutions below them their handmaidens, like referring to Jefferson's comment. But what I'm talking to these family entrepreneurs, and I'm saying, look, you need a decentralized local economic narrative championed. And this is what the Greens are championing. And they're reacting to this, and they're putting my campaign sign in their windows. And so we're getting into a place right now where we're starting to see how the establishment, politics as usual, is not serving the people anymore. It's not serving the people anymore in regard to Iraq. It's not serving the people anymore in regard to the environment, in regard to health issues. I mean, United States. We need to have universal health care here. We have it up here in Canada. You know, I'm speaking from Vancouver again. But we don't have it in the United States, and yet we spend twice as much as any other industrialized nation on health care. I mean, when you connect the dots of that equation, it's obvious that the pharmaceutical and medical industry have a stranglehold on our political structures, just like all the other multinational conglomerates. And that stranglehold needs to be lifted. Those chains need to be busted.
Right, and it's such an interesting scam. They've got us trapped in so many different ways in which we have to give up more and more of our personal data and information, which would then be dumped into a magnificent pot, which could be then stolen quickly for identity theft. It's also, as you were mentioning, the corporate state or fascism. You take it straight back to Mussolini and Rocco's treatise on the corporate state, which Adolf Hitler lifted and turned into his version of fascism. So
sure.
It is specifically a round table of corporate monopolies that each of the monopolies of the nation sit at the round table and decide how the nation is run. And, of course, the people still have a vote. But in order for the people to vote for someone strong enough to compete against each of these monopolies, they have to elect a dictator. And as soon as they elect a dictator, that's the end of the right to vote. And it's this madness that even as children we were told with Aesop's fables and the earliest nursery rhymes, don't put all your eggs in one basket. And the corporate state is purely that. They are there's no reason for Bush claiming to be a conservative to allow these corporations to merge and merge and merge. That's putting all the eggs in one basket, and it shows the mockery that whether it's the Democrats or the Republicans, they're all allowing these corporations to further merge. It's very strange, as you were mentioning, Rupert Murdoch, he, Reverend Moon with the Washington Times, many of these major corporations are now owned overseas. The idea that America would allow its media to be owned by foreign entities, especially by someone as disreputable as Rupert Murdoch or Reverend Moon.
Yeah, I was offered an ambassador for peace by one of the shell organizations for Reverend Moon's Federation of World Peace, I believe it's called. If I got that wrong, my apologies to Federation of World Peace. And I quickly did a search on Reverend Moon on the internet and found out that he is the true parent, along with his wife, of humanity, and that the third messianic narrative or some such thing, you know, that he is forwarding. And my campaign manager, Rebecca Gonzalez Tobias, who works with the United Nations High Commissioner on Human Rights and is on a great deal of peace organizations and boards down here in Southern California, we quickly backpedaled a little bit from that opportunity to be crowned by the true parent of humanity, so to speak.
You know, it's funny.
The top-down model that corporations are built on, which is essentially CEO, makes more than the vice president, makes more than the managers and directors below them, this sort of trickle-down model. This model is parroted by our current political structures, and this is what represents the failure for these political structures to truly be the embodiment of a democratic and representative people's will. And so one of the key values of the Green Party, the 10 key values, which is kind of like the 10 commandments and operates as the political solution set to save civilization from self-destruction. These 10 key values, which I forwarded at the World Peace Forum, one of them is grassroots democracy, which essentially says that the people, the individual, personal perspective, it needs to be built upon up towards the overarching structures above them. It's a feminine vessel of democratic representative will. And it kind of mirrors what occurs in the information and communications revolution today. The internet is this decentralized, amorphous, it's peer-to-peer democracy, if you will. And this sort of decentralized capacity is really the expression of grassroots democracy. And this has to be the system that we bring online to act as an accurate check and balance towards the monolithic institutions of profit, or what I like to say sometimes, the MNMNCs, or man-negating multinational conglomerates. We have to have an accurate check and balance on that, and it's going to have to be a grassroots democratic expression globally.
Well, well said. Speaking locally, how can people get involved in your campaign? Do you have offices up in San Fernando, Van Nuys?
Office is in my apartment. I'm a renter. Please get in touch. My cell phone number is 818-974-8964, which is my direct line, and Rebecca Gonzalez Tobias's cell number is 310-916-8888, or you can just send an email to info@delereforcongress.org. We're going to be canvassing neighborhoods a ton, and creating some out-of-the-box kind of media events down there to shake up an incumbent who probably feels pretty invulnerable right now. But we're going to be coming on strong come November, and if a minor political revolution takes place and we're able to send the first green to Washington, D.C., I'm going to talk about how this is a paradigm shift, and I'm going to have a media bully pulpit being the first green sent to Washington, D.C. that transcends one out of 435 House members. And that little media opportunity will give the progressives in America a chance to really voice some of these stories that are left out by the PR arm of big business or the mainstream media or the two corporate handled parties. And voicing our concern about these issues and the need to have a fundamental shift in our political structures to arrive at a survivable future is, I consider, to be the really patriotic thing to do today. And so this is why I've thrown my hat in the ring to try to address this new and not so different slave issue that we must resolve, which is our humanity and compassion shackled to the whiplash of the bottom line.
Well, if nothing else, you're going to be one of the fine historical orators of Congress. Hey, well, thanks again. So we've been speaking with Byron Dallier, and to find his website, he's running for the 28th Congressional District in Los Angeles. Essentially, it's northern Los Angeles, up the valley. It's www.dallier, D-E-L-E-A-R, For Congress, and that's spelled out, forcongress.org. And we thank you again, Byron. And, yeah, we'll try to do another interview as we get on toward Election Day. You're now past the primary, and it's on to November for you, right?
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, David. And I really want to express my appreciation for you as a soldier of independent media, a soldier of truth, because it's the independent media evolution that is going to bring these stories to light and percolate out into the masses and get this job done, which we need to do today.
All a matter of self-preservation.
Be good.
Thanks again, Byron.
Thank you very much.
And you're listening to Indie Bay Radio in San Francisco, a part of the Radio Indie Media Network. And so you can find this interview at radio.indiemedia.org. And we'll be posting other interviews with other third-party candidates throughout the rest of the campaign year.